Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Whiskey Congress is back in session. Steve is unable to join us today because he's got a bunch of stuff going on with his family, so he will not be here. But luckily enough, we have our regular guest host, Ben from My Whiskey Den, is with us. Ben's show, My Whiskey Den, is on YouTube. Typically, new live episodes are on Monday evenings. But you can also look at archived episodes. They've been doing a lot of Irish whiskey stuff lately. So anyway, we're glad to have you. How you doing, Ben?
Hey, doing great. Glad to be on. Thanks for the invite.
Good to have you. Do you want to throw any social media info about My Whiskey Den out there?
Yeah, you can find us on Facebook, on Instagram, and of course YouTube. We do the live shows, like you said, on Monday. Typically, we're interviewing a distiller or somebody from the industry. And during the week, we usually release some recorded reviews of various whiskey products and spirits. We try to have a lot of fun, keep it enjoyable, but also keep it really informative as well. So
it's a really cool show. I would recommend anyone who wants to learn about whiskey to watch it. It's cool because you've got four or five guys, depending on the show, in different parts of the country. So you got a guy from Wisconsin, a guy from South Carolina, one guy from Missouri. I forget.
Yeah, that's it. That's the three of us.
Okay. And then your guest. Right. There we go.
Right.
Okay. Well, anyway, bunch of stuff to talk about this week. It's something that you sent my way that I am glad you did is the Biden administration was given a deadline to pull completely out of Afghanistan. It was a date initially established under the Trump administration, and Biden said he was going to honor that date. And now that date is rapidly approaching. The date is May 1st, and he's getting some pushback from some of the Democratic senators on the Armed Services Committee and the Foreign Affairs Committee or some other committee. I forget. I'm drawing a blank. But I've got some thoughts on this, but as a guest, I'll let you go first. What are your thoughts on the May 1st deadline and possibly pulling out?
Honestly, for me, I mean, just personally, there's a lot of mixed emotions because, I mean, this goes obviously back to 9/11, all the things that, you know, we've gone through as a nation since that point. You've had, good grief, countless numbers of servicemen and women that have served during that time. You know, this is our longest ongoing military affair, I guess you would say. I don't know if you call it not technically a war, or maybe it is.
I think technically it is.
Global war on terror, but in hindsight, playing Monday morning quarterback, you know, you can look back and see obviously a lot of mistakes we made going in. But I've always been the type of person that, you know, if we're going to commit to a battle, commit to a war, commit to doing something, see it through and finish it out. Because the people, the men that we've lost, the men and women that we've lost there, and those that have sacrificed a great deal in serving there, I don't want to see that sacrifice in vain. But at the same point, when you start looking this politically and from a lot of other factors, you just kind of go, maybe this is where you really do, you cut your losses and you move on. However, the whole issue for me is the way Trump set this up, and he pretty much just set it up pretty hastily and just kind of dumped it into the lap of his predecessor with Biden. And now we're stuck with this deadline. And one of the interesting things is what I'm seeing in most of the media reports is, okay, we have this May 1st deadline. Are we pulling out or are we not? But when you actually dig into the deal, you realize that there were some parameters that needed to be met by Afghanistan and the Taliban at the time. And they have not necessarily lived up to their side of the bargain. So it's not just a do or die kind of thing. It's not a, well, do we pull out or don't we pull out? Well, there were some parameters set up that the Taliban needed to meet, and they haven't exactly met those. So it puts Biden, I think, into a sticky situation here of do we fulfill it and do we back out? Because potentially if you don't, you know, you could see some serious uptick in violence going on there. And then obviously from the hawks in this country, they're going to cry and want us to probably commit more troops, and hey, we need to go in and get this settled, and we're just back in the whole cycle of mess all over again. So,
yeah, my big concern is I don't know what victory looks like at this point.
Yeah,
I mean, the Taliban has been marginalized, to say the least, but Afghanistan as a country is just a mess. I mean, right, it's very tribal in the literal sense of the word. Maybe it's progressed in the last 20 years, but it's I would not bet on that. And I don't know what victory looks like. And I don't know. I understand the logic of we've invested so much in terms of you know, loss of life and loss of, you know, money. So we got to see it through. I understand that thought, but I also can't help but get the don't throw good money after bad concept out of my head. So I like the word Monday morning quarterbacking because that's what I'm doing right now. And I'm always hesitant to do it. I'm not a military guy, nor do I claim to know how this should be handled. But to me, if we don't have a clear objective, I understand the concept of if we leave, we're creating a potential breeding ground for terrorism. I don't see how we avoid that, though. I'd much rather spend the energy and money protecting us here, you know, on intelligence and on special forces strikes if and when needed, than to maintain a military presence there, unless they're doing something to stabilize a region that otherwise will go into just, you know, retaliatory murders, which is entirely possible. So I don't know the answer, but I do know I like the idea of I don't like the idea of saying, let's stay there until we can say we've won if we don't even know what victory looks like.
And I think that gets back to the problem. You look at, what was the release? I think it's called the Pentagon Papers.
Yep.
Dug into some reports by various military leaders from 6 months in. And basically, we were just barely getting started in there, and it was already a massive mess. And nobody knew what the objective was. The goalposts were constantly changing. And, you know, the reports were over one province, whoever was the general or colonel or whoever was over that post would basically file reports saying, you know, I've got things looking good. And then the next guy comes in to replace him and finds out it's an absolute mess. And so everybody just covering their own behind basically was, I won't say false reports, but basically pumping up the reports coming back to the Pentagon that, hey, I've got things cleaned up, I've got things looking good here, when really that wasn't happening at all. And we had no goal from the get-go. So, you know.
Right. The goal to stop the spread of communism.
Should we have just gone in and blasted Al-Qaeda, pay back for 9/11, fine, great, then get the hell out. But, you know, no, that's not what we've done. And now we've spent so much time and so much money there. And, yeah, I'm kind of more of the heart and mind of, you know what, let's cut our losses where they are. And, because as you pointed out, it's so tribal. Unless you just come in there and completely gut the country, how do you rebuild it into anything that, of course, this gets into whole other issues with, you know, foreign policy and whatnot with the U.S. involvement. Do we want to come in and reshape something to look like America, American democracy, because that tends to be our mindset, that somehow people will embrace it and that's what they want? But I don't think that's, you know, that obviously hasn't happened there. The Taliban, who we try to take out, well, guess what? They're the ones still running the show.
And I think you can call some levels of victory, right? Al-Qaeda has been essentially wiped out. Osama bin Laden is dead. So, I mean, killing one guy does not make the whole thing a victory. I don't know what the right answer is. I know that Biden's in a tough spot, and I will say that I'm glad that he's not knee-jerk doing – he's not doing the Trump at Trump and saying, well, you said this, so I'm going to just talk about how stupid you were and how lucky you are to have me, and we're going to do something – we're going to reverse what you said. I'm glad he didn't do that, and I do have faith in Biden to listen to the right people. I just don't know if the right people really know what the right answer is. That was really awkwardly worded, but – I think the point is that if you can't define what victory is, just having our service members in harm's way does not make sense to me.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's where I get around to not having the objective. And then the reality is I'm going to throw this back on Trump. I know, you know, you guys like to shit on him all the time, which is fine with me. I'm right there with you because the guy's just made some horrible decisions. But here is something to me that is as big a deal as withdrawing from Afghanistan And it was hastily thrown together right at the end of his administration. Basically, it's like, oh, I made this campaign promise 4 years ago that I'm going to withdraw and get out of all the wars, and I need to do that. How quickly can we wrap this up? And then we'll set this deadline, and if I win the election, then I'm here to deal with it. If I don't, then now my predecessor has to deal with it. And that's exactly where we're at. And it just, you know, the classic kick the can down the road, and Biden's having to clean up the mess, so to speak, and he's, you know, kind of stuck with it. And
yeah, and the question is, will he clean it up?
To me, it just reflects, again, back poorly on some Trump issues when it comes to foreign policy here. So
yeah, and I mean, that was one of the few things that Trump was campaigning on that I actually was very hopeful about, because
right.
You know, I thought building a wall along the southern border was just a dumb idea, and I've said that 100 times on the show and many other times in other places. But I think which doesn't mean I'm not for border security, by the way. It just means I think building a physical wall of that length is just dumb. But you know, getting out of foreign engagements, especially ones that don't offer, you know, material or political benefits to the U.S., I'd rather stay out of that shit. And I know, I mean, you know, right after 9/11, I was as angry as anybody, and I wanted to see America go in and kick ass somewhere. I was even dumb enough to buy into the Iraq thing for about 2 months. You know, getting out of these wars, you know, in the Democratic primaries, I was a big Tulsi Gabbard fan because that's what she was all about.
Yeah.
Anyway, it'll be important to keep an eye on, and Biden's going to probably do some tap dancing because he's got folks in his own party who are saying this isn't wise, and I'm just hoping he has the good sense to listen to the right people. And I guess the first thing you got to do is identify who the right people are. And that's not even the only kind of big story from foreign affairs. So Biden went pretty strong against Putin and against China in interviews on, I think it was with George Stephanopoulos on ABC, but whatever. He was asked if Putin was a killer, and he said, uh-huh, which I don't know why that's shocking to anyone, because Putin, right. I mean, Putin has killed people and basically bragged about it. When Trump was confronted with the same question, his response was, lots of people are killers. And Biden just went, yeah, we know this. The guy is former KGB and willing to murder and do the wink, wink. I didn't know about this. So I've got a few other thoughts on that. But again, I want to be throw to you and see what your thoughts are.
I mean, I have two main thoughts on it. First of all is, you know, hey, okay, nice approach. Because I go back to George W. Bush when he was first elected and Putin was in office. I don't know if you remember.
I do all too well.
Bush walks out and says, I looked into his eyes and I saw his soul.
Right.
Kind of just crappy comment. And so, okay, you saw his soul. Well, did you actually see what the guy really is? Because he's an absolute dirtbag. And
yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Bill Maher's line was, I look into that guy's eyes, I see pools of sulfur.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, so Putin's brilliant. I don't
Biden's
ever.
At least Biden's calling him out for what he is, you know.
And sure.
You know, with going back with what we've dealt with Russia for the last bit, I don't have a problem with it. I appreciate a strong stance on that. Now, my other thing is, okay, that's talk. What are we going to do about it? What's the action here? What is your actual foreign policy in dealing with Russia moving forward? Because I haven't really seen a lot of that vetted out yet. So,
and it's tricky with Russia and China, yeah, because we have a lot of interdependencies. You know, Russia has been a hostile nation to us for a very long time. We sort of play nicer now than we did back in the 70s and 80s, but you know, they're still clearly a hostile nation, and we're viewed by them as a hostile nation. Putin is a brilliant man. He's just fucking evil.
Yep.
I don't use the word evil very often. With him, I'm quite comfortable doing it. The only thing that makes me even a little bit uncomfortable is the thought that he would hear this and have me whacked. Steve has talked about how much he wants to party with Putin, and that makes me more nervous now than it ever has before. But yeah, here's what he is. And what I thought the most chilling thing in that whole exchange was Putin's response. I wish Joe Biden health.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
you know, the Godfather kissing you on the lips. You're fucked.
Right. And that's the comparison I was going to make. He's basically the Godfather of Russia, pretty much. I mean, it would be a great way to,
yeah,
you know, look at how he runs things. But
Yep. And again, he's very good at it. And
scary guy. Yeah, I'm sure he does throw a great party. So
I'm sure he does too.
Probably enjoy that. But
and yeah, well, if I find out Steve and Putin are hanging out and that Putin heard this, I'm blockading my door. So another with regards to China is a very difficult country to deal with. Biden is loosening some tariffs, but keeping the main ones on China, which again, if that's what the folks who know economics and international affairs believe is the best way to go, stick with it. I don't know what the right answer is. I do know China is definitely a hostile nation. I mean, with all this COVID, the conspiracy theories revolving around COVID, the one that I do not dismiss at all is the possibility that this was for lack of a word, biological warfare, whether it was a mistake that it got out or whether it wasn't, I don't feel like I have any insight to. But when I hear people say, yeah, you know, COVID was Bill Gates did this and blah, that's nonsense. But when people say, well, the Chinese government may have, you know, done this, I don't dismiss that offhand.
I don't dismiss it at all. As a matter of fact, I read a report just about maybe a week, 2 weeks ago. I do not recall the guy's name. I wish I could pull it up and find it right now, but he was a lead investigator for the Defense Department. Apparently, he's responsible for tracking down Pakistan's nuclear program when they were developing things. He's very good at following the money, et cetera. And he clearly pointed out that he believed this was the evidence that we have on hand is this was released out of the lab in Wuhan, whether, you know, again, intentional or accidental. But he's pointing to the first 20 cases that they tracked coming out of China of flu-like symptoms. This goes back into November, were from within the direct vicinity of the lab, the supposed wet market that China's trying to say this came from, and as well as a number of others. There were no direct cases that can be tied directly to that wet market. That particular lab, you can go do a quick Google search. I'm not sending you down any conspiracy sites, but go straight to standard normal media news sites and you will find a number of articles that deal with the fact that this lab has a history of violations and leaks. Also, we are tied into that lab. We have a number of universities here in the United States that have helped with the research. We've got money involved with helping China in that part. So you kind of wonder if you want to go down the conspiracy rabbit hole, okay, maybe this is why we are covering up, because, yeah, China's responsible, and you know what? We got money tied up in there too, so we don't want this coming back on us either. But as far as just logically breaking this down, I think it's the most logical reasoning for how this all started.
I agree, in the sense that I don't believe someone ate a pangolin and caused a global pandemic. I just, right. I'm not saying it's not possible. I just, one guy, I love the South Park pandemic special where someone had sex with a bat. It was Mickey Mouse and the guy, Stan Marsh or whatever. And then he was having sex with a pangolin. And it was, if you haven't seen the South Park pandemic special, you should. It is phenomenal.
I haven't yet. I need to.
Well, spoiler alert.
No problem.
But it's been out for like 3 months. That's on you. But but again, I've had a very hard time believing that someone eating an animal that wasn't cleaned properly was the cause of all of this. And again, I don't put it past China to hurt their own citizens for the sake of their government's greater good. I'm being harsh there, but I think the history tends to back up that statement.
I think obviously the clear history with China, with their government, just honestly with communism, the state is the greater good. Everything for the glory of the state, if you will.
Right.
So, and China really is. They're such, when it comes to the entanglements we have here in the U.S., it's a hot mess. It's kind of like Hell Hydra. You know, you've got so many tentacles spread throughout so many things, whether it's economics, military, or whatever, that it makes it really difficult to take a really hard line stance, because you're going to pay one way or the other in dealing with China. It's just trying to figure out which poison do you want to swallow. The thing that I'm watching for with China, and that's what for me, I've been following and kind of digging on them for probably 20 years now. And when I talk to a lot of people, most people actually aren't aware of China has what's called the 2030 plan. Have you heard of this?
I have, but refresh my memory.
Okay. This was spoken back, going back into the 90s. Their generals, their military leaders, they spoke openly within China. There's speeches, you can go back and look. But they have strategic military plans to take back Taiwan by 2030. That's their goal. 2020 at the earliest, which obviously didn't happen, but 2030. So if you look at what they're building up in the South China Sea, you look at the aggressive military stances they're taking, at a number of the things, they want to be in position to be able to militarily retake Taiwan by 2030 and pretty much shut the U.S. off of that, because we are, I believe it's by treaty, you know, we're responsible for defending Taiwan, helping defend Taiwan. And so there's a number of things they have done over the years, whether it be espionage and, you know, stealing our military secrets to, one of the things, and this is just in the wide open, go look at, and this is one of the strategies that our Pentagon research, they knew the Chinese were planning this. And so this is what kind of blows my mind a little bit about, and obviously you don't know what's going on behind doors, but when you hear the public speaking, this plan is well known within the Pentagon. It's well known within, upper levels of government. Nobody talks about it. What are we going to do about it? If Taiwan is actually we're supposed to protect them, what are we doing? Because you go back and look, a couple of the things China's done is they control both ends of the Panama Canal. One of the reasons for that is it's tied to the 2030 plan, because they actually plan, part of that plan is if they feel the need to, they will preeminently strike the U.S. fleet in the Pacific to prevent them from defending Taiwan. Well, the U.S. response would be to send the Atlantic fleet over. Well, they can't. At least they would be held up for a time if China has shut down the Panama Canal, which would be the quickest route through over there. So there's different things they have done to position themselves to be able to fulfill this desire they have, as well as the buildup of the bases and all the constant naval action that's going on in the South China Sea that we hear all the reports about. We had, I think, a naval ship sail through there recently, got a little close. China raised Cain about it. You have their aircraft is constantly doing flybys of our Pacific fleet. So there's a lot of tension building up, and that's what they're trying to escalate to. That's one of their goals. And so what do we do about that? Again, no discussion of it. Where does all this tie in? So Biden wants to take a stance against China. How do you do that when they've got legitimate military goals? And are we even really preparing for that? Because we've been fighting a war on terror in the Middle East for the last 20, 25 years. And, there's always some talk about China, but.
Yeah, I think China, my thing with China is they never really had their day in the sun as one of the world's top two superpowers, at least not in the minds of people like me who, just see things through the American media and a little bit of foreign media. I think they're positioned to get that now. I think Russia has obviously, had their run and then fucked things up, and they're trying to rebuild their former glory. The U.S., I think, is kind of in the middle. We were definitely, when the Soviet Union was our clear enemy and China was kind of this vague, they're communists, but they don't like Russia. So, they're kind of in straddling the fence. Now, right, it's such a clear global economy, and China's manufacturing power is so overwhelming, and they're building their military up to the point where I think they said they've got the largest navy in the world now. And by the way, they've got 1.4 billion people. So they've got five times our population. At some point, just throwing people at things becomes an option, and they can do that to us in massive numbers. So yeah, the Chinese government's very scary.
That gets back not just to an interest as far as government, foreign policy, military, whatnot. So just to play out, let's say they make a move on Taiwan. What then? What do we do?
Right.
At this point, do we just secede Taiwan to them? Hey, sorry guys, China's too big. from my standpoint, the business I'm involved in, one of our leading suppliers is based out of Taiwan. So what does that do for our business if China militarily takes over?
Yeah. And I, you know, and that's
there, so there's all kinds of interest involved in this, and it's
That would be an incredibly sticky situation, because the idea of sending U.S. servicemen and women to defend Taiwan, to me, yeah. I mean, if it's a treaty and we have an obligation, I understand it. But also, I can see how that could get real ugly real fast, and we want to send the world's economy into a death spiral, get the U.S. and China, you know, exchanging legitimate military blows.
Exactly. And that for me, I guess, is the importance of that, is how dangerous that can spiral out of control and what that can lead to. So I would love to actually see some political leaders address this, you know, whether it be Biden or whoever. Just what is, because obviously a lot of that treaty, a lot of that came out of our policy back in the, you know, way back when we're dealing with the spread of communism and we're trying to combat that at all costs. And now it's, well, is that even really something we want to be that concerned about anymore? Honestly?
Looking.
Okay. So it's.
Go ahead.
Do we really want to tie ourselves into potential for sparking World War III over protecting a small island in the South Pacific? I hate to sound that trivial, but that's a reality there.
So. Right. And I mean, we took on the role of world police whenever we did, whether it was after World War II or think that's where I would say it became the thing. But is there a way out of that role? Because I'd rather not be in that role. It's complicated and, like you said, very dangerous. If I switch to a slightly lighter side, we talked about the tariffs on China and Biden's administration maintaining the most significant ones. One tariff that's been reduced, for at least for the next 4 months, is tariffs on Scotch whiskey, which, again, you brought to my attention, and I appreciate it. I damn near went out and bought a bottle of Laphroaig to drink while talking to you. I'm a huge Islay Scotch fan.
I'm right there with you. Yeah, that's great. Great classic whiskey.
And Laphroaig is great. Lagavulin, I would say, is better, but it's also like 50% more expensive. So my cheapness and my enjoy of smoky, peaty Scotch whiskeys come into conflict there. But yeah, that's an interesting thing to me. And as two guys who drink whiskey, that's good news.
It is. It is good news. But it's also one of the issues in that article is the tariffs on U.S. whiskeys coming into the U.K. have not been dropped. And U.S. Distilleries lost, what was that, like 57 million? Yeah, 57 million in sales or something like that last year because of these tariffs. And so coming off of the COVID economy, which has had a harsh impact on the service industry, which ties into distilleries and alcohol production and sales, something like that hurts a lot. And so, again, we see this whole tariff war, and you know, whatever your views are on it, that pro or against, with that Trump got us into on all of this, it's great seeing some of this come off, because honestly, yeah, I've been discouraged from buying any Scotch because a lot of these bottles have gone up in price a lot, and it's just, you know, you start to lose the value on it. It's not worth the value at the cost they are. But so hopefully we're going to see those prices come down. But I'd also love to see this, you know, get addressed, and for our own distilleries here being able to import over to Europe and to the UK and all. And that's something I guess has been surprising to me, because as quick as Biden was talking about coming in an executive order and, you know, nullifying a lot of the actions of the Trump administration, I would have expected this would have been something would have been dealt with even a little bit quicker, some of the whole tariff thing, because politically, if I remember that, you know, that particular side, the Democrats really cried a lot about, you know, going into a tariff war and whatnot, and whether that's actually good for the economy or not good. And it just seems to me this is something that would have been tackled, but they're kind of letting certain parts of that go. Other parts are taken care of right now, but certain things are still ongoing. So I'm curious to see what they're going to do with this.
Well, and I believe if I remember from the article correctly, there's only a 4-month reprieve on the tariff. So yeah. I'm wondering if they're using that as a way of negotiating. Hey, Scotland, we'll play nice with you. Or hey, UK, we'll play nice with you. Don't you want to play nice with us? I probably don't know anybody who knows craft American distilleries better than you. And so do you, when you talk to those guys, do they ever bring up tariffs and the economic impact?
It's actually for craft distillers because they don't have the distribution level that your big distillers do, like sure. Buffalo Trace and Sazerac, Heaven Hill, Wild Turkey, Jack Daniels, you know, Old Farm. Those guys, sure. they're the big guys, they're the big players. They get the big distribution overseas. So it's really more of a direct impact on those guys. The craft distillers, their concerns is more about distribution here in the U.S., dealing with antiquated laws coming out of prohibition that really restricts their sales. And the states, some of these states are very, honestly, very arcane, like Texas. You can pick up 2 bottles from a distillery each month in person, and that's it.
Okay.
And some states, even, I believe, it may have been Minnesota, where the distillery has to sell the bottles to the distributor and then buy them back in order to sell them directly from the distillery itself. So just some stupidity and things like that. They got a big boost here at the end of the year. There was set to where with the COVID law, you know, some of the COVID bills, they gave a huge tax relief to the craft distillers, and that was set to expire at the end of the year. And they were about to see, about a 500% tax increase on what they're doing. And fortunately got that passed at the last second, and they got the protection for that. So I think it's seeing that kind of thing made permanent so that they can actually compete with the big guys, because that's a big part of it is there's a lot of, restrictions and things on the craft distillers that hinder them from being able to be competitive with a lot of the big guys. And so I think for them, it's more important to deal with that. As far as the tariff, yeah, on the big distillers, MGP, Wild Turkey, Sazerac, all those guys, that's where the tariffs really come into play, because those guys have the distribution.
Overseas. Right. No, that makes perfect sense. I'm glad we're having this topic on with you on the show. I'm going to veer down the straight whiskey path for a second. I've maintained for a long time that you can find some really good, very reasonably priced bourbons. I'm going to use $30 a bottle as my cutoff. And there's plenty of really good stuff out there for $30 a bottle. There's some great stuff more than that. There's some not so great stuff that costs more than that. But I've got the bottle of Lusty Claw staring at me as I'm saying this. If you've ever had that stuff, it is absolute trash, and it's a running joke between Steve and I. Very hard to find a good cheap scotch.
Yes.
The only one I will go to, and I get criticized pretty roughly for this, have you ever had White Horse?
Yes.
I think White Horse is a pretty decent, very reasonably priced scotch. It's a blend, but it's a blend that uses actually a lot of Lagavulin in it. So it's got a little bit of smoke. It's got a little bit of peat. It is very, I think it's a bottle is $15 in Ohio roughly. And I consider that to be the best cheap scotch you're going to find. And there are some awful ones. If you, I'm drawing a blank on the name of it, but there's a scotch that I got sick on in grad school that if you put it under my nose today, you would probably cause me to throw up.
I don't doubt it.
I forget. I'm drawing a blank.
My first experience with scotch back in high school, I remember being something so horrible, I stayed away from scotch for a long time. That's a big debate within the whole whiskey community in general, is the value of bourbon versus the value of scotch, because you can find a good $20 bottle of bourbon. I mean, go pick up a Wild Turkey 101. That's actually legitimately good stuff, and you're usually going to pay $18 to $20 for it.
Right.
Early Times barreled in bond, the Evan Williams bottled in bond.
Oh, that's great stuff.
That one is fantastic. There may not be a better bourbon for the money than the Evan Williams, that white label. But you can pick up some good, bottom shelf bourbons, but that same price range, you try to find scotch, and the literal word rock gut, you know.
Right. Oh, there's awful stuff out there.
Yeah. There's a few that I think are really good to check out. Always depends on availability in your area, but Teachers Highland Cream is a good, got a little bit of smoke to it. That's a good budget scotch. My favorite for the money is, if you're familiar with the Famous Grouse, they have one called the Naked Grouse, which is, it's not a blended scotch. Well, it's a blend, but it's not. Blended scotch typically has, you have single malts involved, but you also have single grain whiskeys. And that's usually what gives it a real kind of harshness. So Naked Grouse is actually a blend of all single malts. And they're using, I believe there's Macallan in the mix, there's Highland Park in the mix. I don't remember what the third distillery is, but it's just a really nice bottle that I'd put up against some single malts, to be honest.
I'll look around for that.
So that one, and it's usually in about the $20, $25 range, I think, at least around here in South Carolina. So that's a great one. Who else? If you're familiar with... let's see, there's one called Great King Street. That's another blend. Those are fantastic. And they're put out by Compass Box, which is really produces more high-end blends. Most people think of good scotch, they think of single malts. Blends tend to be put down a lower category, but Compass Box produces some extremely good blends, but you're going to pay a lot for them. You know, we're talking $200, $300 a bottle.
Yeah,
but they're using you know 24 and 26 year old whiskeys in the mix and all, but they produce some lower end stuff called Great King Street that's in that $20 range. That's a fantastic blended scotch as well in that kind of budget range. That's very good value.
Good tips. I'll take a look for both those things. So one other thing I want to kind of talk about the Biden administration over, and I'm actually really angry about this, is multiple staffers have been fired or asked to resign because they admitted to using cannabis in official government forms.
Right.
Now, at least a few of them that were brought up in this article said that they had only used it in places where it's recreationally legal. And right. While I don't want to say this is, you know, Biden personally putting the stamp down on this, he's responsible. It's his administration. I'm not saying that I'm not saying he signed off on them personally, but he sure as hell didn't stop it.
Right.
And I think that's obscene.
Yeah, there's a couple questions I have on it. Number one, the thing we got, you know, you have to know is exactly as stated here, the White House gets to call the shots on this. So they set the standards for hiring here. So it's up to them if they want to allow recreational marijuana use or if they allow it for a few times or not. And the statement from most of these people fired is they were not told, or they were told that, hey, you know, you've used it some, that's okay, not a problem. Now that you're hired, oh, we're coming back to tell you that is a problem. So you're being let go or you're being shuffled around. The question I have for the people that have been fired from this so far is I want to know, was their job position requiring top secret clearance? Because I think that's one of the things where it gets a lot more restrictive in the hiring. And granted, if that's the case, they should have been more upfront with this. But that's where it comes into a little bit of question for me is, okay, what job position were you seeking? What were the requirements? And if you were getting top secret clearance, then maybe that's something they need to revisit or take a look at. But from personal standpoint, yeah, I think in this day and age, that's bullshit, just straight up.
Well,
especially coming from, but then again, I don't know, with this administration, you know, Biden is not quite the progressive that obviously a lot of Republicans want to make him out to be. He never has been. So,
no, he's anti-weed. I mean, he's flat out said it.
I find it surprising, I guess.
What bothers me the most is when you get down to it, you're punishing people for telling the truth.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and I mean, until almost my 48th birthday, I could have told you honestly I had never smoked weed in my life. I can no longer say that. I'm paranoid, not because of the impact of cannabis, but because I don't want my mom to find out I smoked weed through my own show. And honestly, I don't I don't regret it. I actually kind of enjoy it, and I don't regret having waited as long as I did, but I also don't regret that I sort of took my own bias that was pounded into my head since I was a, you know, preteen, that if you smoke marijuana, you become a dope head. And I stayed away from it in high school, stayed away from it in college with plenty of opportunities to consume. And then finally I said, I'm just following my own stupid bias. I'm going to give this stuff a try. And like, you know what? Yeah. It's making me drink less. It's helping me sleep better. I still go back at all the folks who claim that cannabis cures cancer and all that nonsense. I mean, it's not the miracle drug that's going to cure the world, but it's certainly no worse than booze. In fact, I would argue from a health perspective and from a societal perspective, it's a whole lot less harmful than booze. And I think the data would back me up pretty clearly on that. But I'm very annoyed that they're, well, first of all, I'm annoyed that they haven't already had something in the works to get a bill on the president's desk and say, sign it or don't, and have Kamala Harris looking over her shoulder going, dude, I ran with you because I wanted to get this shit done. Quit being a grouchy old man and put your name on this piece of paper. And let's end the bull. You're talking about dumb laws with regards to booze, and there are certainly tons of them. There, it's embarrassing to me that as a country,
honestly,
it is. It's crazy. But with weed, I think the laws are even more damaging because, you know, in the state of Michigan, it's recreationally legal. I can drive 2 hours, purchase cannabis, consume it in an appropriate place, and I am being completely lawful according to the standards of the state of Michigan. If I then took that cannabis and drove it back into Ohio, I know I'm not being lawful. Now, it's decriminalized in Ohio, but I don't know what that means in terms of if I have two packs of gummies, am I over the amount for decriminalization? I don't fucking know. And
then you have questions federally because it has not been decriminalized on the federal level, and you just brought it across state lines. So what?
Trust me, I've thought about that, and I never said I did bring it across state lines. I said if I brought it across state.
I know. I'm playing along with that scenario. So.
Thank you. But the truth is, people talk. Once I started consuming weed, I started noticing it's fucking everywhere. Not just in, you know, people vaping in the bar sitting next to me, or, you know, in a park or whatever, but watching movies and realizing there's been weed going around this. I watched something about Mary the other day, and there's a scene where Cameron Diaz and Ben Stiller are passing a joint in front of her apartment building. I watched that movie. I've watched it multiple times. I'd never noticed that before. And I'm like, it's fucking everywhere. Just like prohibition. It doesn't work. Let's be logical and reasonable. Draw the line where you have to draw the line, and, you know, pretend. Go ahead.
I agree, and I think the irony of all this is, from what I understand, I believe I saw yesterday or 2 days ago that Pelosi is presenting a bill to decriminalize this on the federal level in the House. So here you've got a bill being presented to decriminalize this, and they're turning around and firing staffers because of previous use.
Right.
So.
Right. And I believe both the House and Senate have bills that would pass. But I mean, I think Mitch McConnell had slammed the brakes on any legislation of that nature before. But now the Democrats have no excuses. And, you know, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, where I still have family and where I went to school, is kind of the tipping point for the Democrats being able to get things through with a tie vote, and therefore letting the vice president break the tie. And, hey, Joe, I've been to West Virginia. A lot of folks there smoke weed. A lot of them.
Yep.
I remember a story from college where a guy said that the sheriff's department would literally raid illegal weed farms, harvest cannabis, and then sell it. And they had a sign in their window, out of marijuana, we'll be back soon, or something like that. They were that open about it. And this is in the early 90s.
Yeah.
So
I was going to say, I graduated 1994 from high school. It would be easier for me to go through my high school yearbook and point to all the people who didn't use weed versus all the people who did.
Yeah.
Myself included.
So. Yeah, and again, I didn't do it until I was 47, but I can tell you now, I can say from actual experience, it's really not that bad for you. And it's not a gateway drug. It's I also, since I hang around with a bunch of derelict comics, You know, I was kind of made fun of as the only comic who had never smoked weed until I could no longer claim that. And but the amount of times I've been high around other comics and been offered Adderall or Coke, and I'm like, no, I don't want to do that shit. My heart would explode. So the idea that getting high makes you suddenly a drug fiend is just stupid reefer madness nonsense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that was a fun little. Well, actually, I don't know if it was that much fun. I'm really annoyed with this for the sake of the people who lost their jobs. And so, two other things that are really in the mainstream news right now that are very upsetting to me. Well, one of them is very upsetting to me, and that is the violence against Asians has gone way, way up. And there was the multiple shootings in Atlanta, and there's all kinds of stories coming out saying it was not racially motivated. It was religious, you know, fervor causing this guy to try to prevent himself from sinning. So he went and killed a bunch of people, because that makes perfect fucking sense. But regardless, violence against Asians is stems from a lot of the stuff we talked about before, that people are hearing folks like Trump say, well, the Chinese did this to us. And unfortunately, the average American doesn't know that not all Asians are Chinese. My brother is Korean. He's adopted. My niece and nephew are half, and they live in the incredibly diverse state of West Virginia, so where racism is not a problem at all. And I'm scared for them. It genuinely bothers me that people are targeting Asians just because they look a certain way and Trump wants them to. Maybe that's not quite fair, but.
Yeah. And, honestly, it's like our history in this country with everything else. We don't have the best history of treating Asians very well, whether it be,
the internment camps, obviously.
The internment camps, are the biggest thing. Yeah, I think there were, trying to remember my history here. I believe, didn't we have some Chinese slaves working on railroads or whatnot?
Yeah, I don't know if they were officially slaves. They just were
indentured type.
Yeah, oh, it was awful.
Whatever, but it's we have a horrible history with it. And the fact that, God, you just have, the reality, you have just stupid, stupid people. There's a virus coming from China, so what do we need to do? We go beat up some or kill and murder some Asians, because that's going to fix everything. You know, like I have a hard time understanding the mindset and the reasoning of people that think that way. And so, but when you have Trump, while he's in office and this is coming up, and you know good and well, because of our history, that if something like this comes up or something like this happens, invariably there's going to be a group of people who are going to go try to take out their frustrations. Whatever, I think it just basically, it gives them an excuse in their mindset. It gives them an excuse to live out their racism, basically, and go take this out on whatever group of people. And so one of the most simplest things you can do is, as the mouthpiece, as the leader of the country, is take a very active verbal stand against it. But did he? No.
No.
As a matter of fact,
quite the opposite.
He made statements that quite the opposite tried to encourage it. So could all of this be avoided to a degree? Honestly, I think not. I think you could probably at least stem some of it to a degree, and at least take an active stance against it. And he just absolutely refused to do it, pretty much refused to do it.
No, I think he stoked the flames, I think.
And like you, I've got friends, I've got a lot of people I know in the Asian community. And I'm concerned, and seeing what happened over this past week, and I hate to say, I'm kind of back to that moment I had with Ahmaud Arbery last year that just really pierced my heart in a big way. This is doing the same thing, and I'm pissed off, and I'm trying to figure out how to process and what to do about it, from a personal standpoint.
Yeah.
And that's,
I mean, the number of schoolyard fights I got into because someone was picking on my little brother, I can't even count. I mean, granted, that pretty much ended around eighth grade or ninth grade. But it was, my dad made it clear, it's your job to protect your little brother. And I was in a largely white neighborhood, and there were a bunch of dipshits would call my brother a Jap, and I'd be like, well, he's Korean. What's the difference? Are you Greek or Italian? Oh, I'm Italian. Well, it's the same thing, right? Fuck you. Right. Yeah. I don't remember if I was coached to say that, but I know I've said it multiple times. it's very upsetting and scary. And, you know, you like to think that we're getting better with regards to race in this country. And some days I think things are getting better and some days I don't. In fact, I want to throw in a quick issue that we didn't put on the talking points board, that the Derek Chauvin attorneys tried to move his trial, claiming that because information about the city settling with George Floyd's family had come out, that it was prejudicial, and the judge refused it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, my thought was, where are you going to move it to that no one's going to know about this? I mean,
exactly.
And I don't know from a legal perspective. This is kind of, you know, I wish Steve was here for this, because I don't know legally what a change of venue, you know, when it's considered legally required, and right. Does this give Chauvin a chance to, if he is convicted, to appeal because he was not granted the change of venue? My guess is it probably does give them that option. But realistically, where are you going to put this trial where people are going to A, not know about it, and B, not have formed an opinion? I mean, there were, you know, protests in so many cities around the country that I understand why a lawyer would make the request, but I can also understand why a judge would say, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, I think exactly on both points. It's the lawyers are doing their job. That's what they're hired to do for him. And it's, you know, they're going to grasp at every possible straw they can find to shift this, to delay this, to do whatever they can for their client. And then, you know, kudos on the judge basically calling bullshit on it and just saying, yeah, that's not going to work. So,
yep. And sorry to slip that in there, but that was something I definitely wanted to mention. And then one more thing I want to talk about is the situation going on with Deshaun Watson with regards to accusations of sexual impropriety. Now, I have not heard any details. I believe they all involved workers at massage parlors.
Right.
And now that doesn't justify anything. Ask Robert Kraft.
Right.
But I really want to know what this is all about, because whenever allegations are this vague, and maybe if I dug in, I could find more, but I just heard women have accused him of inappropriate sexual conduct. I get furious when people try to put everything into the same bucket. I've had so many arguments with people who say, if you want to say that Aziz Ansari and Harvey Weinstein belong in the same category, fuck off. Aziz Ansari did something that was maybe a bit pushy on a date with a girl that he had already been sexually active with on that date. And he just wanted reciprocity for oral sex, basically, if I can be blunt enough about it. That's, you know, could that be not classy and, you know, a little icky to see written down? Sure. But it's not sexual assault. Harvey Weinstein physically raped women and potted plants. That's gross. I'm sorry. But the idea of a guy jerking off into a plant just confuses me. I mean, let's go with the word confuses me.
There you go.
Yeah. I'd love to know what motivates that particular act. But anyway, when you want to put everything into the same category, you, in my opinion, do a tremendous disservice to the people who were legitimately abused versus the people who were, you know, put in an awkward situation. If all Deshaun Watson did was ask for a happy ending, not classy. I was going to say it's not illegal, but technically it probably is illegal. But regardless, that's not cool, but it's not a Harvey Weinstein type monster.
In the time this has come out, the last I'll check this today, there were, I believe, 7 women now have come forward with potentially 10 more. So the numbers are going through the roof. Now, unfortunately, you always have to ask, well, how many of these are just coming out to, you know, try to cash in?
Right.
When you're dealing with a celebrity or an athlete, somebody who's got a ton of money, like a Deshaun Watson. But this gets back to the question, and I guess the reason I brought this up to you, we had a conversation with this with friends of mine on Facebook yesterday dealing with this. And it's, so where do you draw the line between believing the woman? Okay, we want to believe, you know, believe her, because we want women to feel safe to come forward to deal with these issues, to see justice served where justice needs to be served, but also with the male, where he is, you know, our legal culture is you are innocent until proven guilty. But when it's a high, when it's a celebrity, when it's a
high profile,
an athlete, when it's, somebody like that, the case is going to be public and they're tried in the, you know, in the public court of opinion before it ever goes to trial. And so have you damaged, have you destroyed their reputation? If they're found innocent, can they recoup from that? So these were, I guess, in the topics of conversation, and that's one of the things that was brought up was, well, how many cases has there been where somebody was, allegations were brought publicly, they were found innocent, and it actually destroyed their reputation to the point they could not recoup?
Sure.
And so that brought to me, it's because, you know, I have a bit of a feminist streak in this, and I want to believe the woman. I want to support her in this. I want to see justice brought. But you do have the cases where, women have made false allegations out of whether revenge, out of seeking money or whatever. And so, and this is where, like, I would love to get Steve's legal input on this, because it's, would it be viable, would it be possible that sexual assault cases, rape cases, these things, they are kept completely sealed by the court until the trial is over?
And I think all of this is civil.
Anything about it, and you would protect both parties involved.
I think all of this is being handled in a civil court too. I don't think there's any criminal investigation, is there?
That I'm not sure. As far as I know, it's still being investigated.
Okay.
So I know but you were talking about details. I know one of the last women that came forward, she gave some pretty descriptive details of what actually went down. And so I think he was trying to force her to have oral sex. He was, moving her hand and trying to hold her in position on certain parts of the body and whatnot.
So that crosses a line for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think this is all in civil courts. And I can tell you that this is a bit weird, but I had a former friend that I later found out said stuff about me that was completely untrue. But she said it, so she's a former friend for, I found this out because of us becoming former friends, but basically she accused me of exposing myself to her when she was with me in my house and we had been drinking. And she said this to her then wife, who's now her ex-wife. And I'm friends with a bunch of people in that community. There's a very close-knit group of lesbian friends that I know a bunch of through different avenues. And I now spent, every time I see them, I wonder, did this get said to them? And again, I'm telling you, what was said about me was a complete fabrication by someone who has proven herself to be an out and out stone cold liar. But, I'm a 40 something white straight dude telling a bunch of, gay women that, hey, this white straight guy did these things. I can't defend myself and say, hey, just so you know, I didn't do that, because how do you even get to that point? But when I heard what was said about me by a person who at that time I considered a friend, who allegedly was laughing to her wife about it, so whatever, I'm furious that I found that out through having drinks with this person's ex-wife and her saying, something weird got said once. And I'm like, okay. And then she told me what was said. And she's like, the response was, you look like you're in shock. I'm like, yeah, I'm in shock. A, that never fucking happened. And the fact that she's going around saying this shit because she thinks it's amusing, while in the meantime, it's probably got at least a few people to think I'm a, Louis C.K.'s creep. And that offends me because I'm not as big a creep, nor am I nearly as good a comic. It's easy to say shit. And it's an ugly game when you try to parse what's, a real victim and what is a person who's an opportunist. And, it's ugly. But I think everything in Deshaun Watson's case is currently in civil courts. And one thing I will say is people often say, well, they're just looking for money. There's other reasons to do things in a civil court. And one of them is the burden of proof is different. And and you get restitution of some kind for what was done to you. If Deshaun Watson physically assaulted a woman, I want him prosecuted. I don't know, as a South Carolina fan, I don't know if you have fondness for Deshaun Watson because of what he did for the state of South Carolina, or anger because he's your rival school.
Coming out of the school, I respect the guy as an athlete. You know, I don't know him personally. I can't claim anything to his character other than what I've heard hearsay from people. But just as an athlete, I totally respect who the guy was and how he played the game. But yeah, the whole civil court case, that's a great point, because a big factor in that is the whole burden of proof is completely different in a civil case versus right. criminal. So,
and in his case, he's trying to get traded. You got to believe this kind of mess affects his tradability, which makes me a little conspiracy theorist about the Houston Texans organization. They don't want to trade the guy. He's saying, get me the fuck out of here. And the fact that these stories come out with all that going on, I'm not saying the Texans organization is using this as a way to thwart that. But if I found that out, it wouldn't shock me. Let's say it that way.
I'll just go ahead and say that thought had already crossed my mind when I saw the cases come out. The first part is, okay, this is terrible if this is true. And then the other part is, this guy's trying to get traded. What an easy way to tank that, to pay some people to bring some false allegations, you know?
And right.
I hate to think that way, but in this day and age, guys, it's hard not to.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I'm, you know, Deshaun Watson beat the Bills in the playoffs 2 years ago. So, and I carry a chip always. But I mean, I do respect him as a football player. And if the Texans organization does have a hand in this, if I'm Deshaun Watson, I'm getting a private investigator to look into that. And while that might end an ugly way for all parties involved, if there's anything to that, if I'm Deshaun Watson, I would want to expose that as blatantly as possible. And right. now that I'm saying that out loud, I'd be kind of disappointed if he hasn't already hired an attorney, and if that attorney hasn't already hired an investigator.
As far as I know, they've already come out with a statement, and the thing I saw today was he is absolutely not going to settle the case because he's, you know, fully convinced he is innocent on all charges. So,
well, and that's the thing, is a lot of times these guys will say, you know, here's 50 grand to just go away, seal this, and right. let's move on. And it's easy for people to say, well, if you didn't do it, why did you settle? There's actually really good reasons to settle, even if you didn't do it, because it might cost you more, both in actual dollars spent and in terms of your reputation, if you just get it to go away. And then the flip side of that is, if a woman takes the settlement, that doesn't mean she wasn't telling the truth. It means she might say, this is causing too much harm to my life, and this at least gives me the satisfaction of saying this was acknowledged. So, you know, when these things get settled, I actually don't take the often referenced stance of, well, if you didn't do it, you shouldn't have paid, or just because she took the money because of, you know, whatever reason, I understand why that happens. Right. Having said that, if he actually stands tough and says, I'm not going to settle, I didn't do this, I would respect that. And right. if it turns out, and again, I know I'm going wild conspiracy theorist here, but if it does turn out that the Houston Texans organization had anything to do with encouraging this, burn that organization to the ground.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if they're real professionals and at what they're doing, then they've made sure there would be no ties to, you know, God, there's plenty of parties, just even out there on political sides, where a politician, something dirty happens, and he can adamantly say, I had no knowledge of that, or I didn't do that, because, yeah, you literally didn't. Your organization hired somebody who hired somebody else so that you literally would have no idea.
Yeah, that's fair. The only thing I would counter that with is there's a lot of stupidity in the world.
Exactly. And I guess for me, the question gets back to, you know, we saw this going through with Kavanaugh, with his confirmation. We're going through this with Cuomo right. as well in New York. And it gets to and this is the question I brought up in the group, was, can we believe the woman 100% and fully investigate? And can we also believe the man is innocent until proven guilty?
Yeah, it's tough.
And, you know, Steve likes to say two things can be true at the same time.
And he's right.
I fully believe that. And that, kind of the same thing in these situations. Can we hold both things societally? I don't think we can. You know, our media and whoever else, and you know, people in general, they suck. So it's you know, anything they can spin or try to get clicks and try to get people tuned in for a headline, sure. But ideally, that's what I would love to see, is that we believe the woman, we 100% support you, we 100% will investigate this fully, but also the man is innocent until proven guilty. And that's
I agree with that completely. And I was going to make another point, and I'm drawing a blank, and it sucks. So I'm going to say words now to last long enough to hopefully have it come back. But we've been talking for a bit over an hour. I greatly appreciate you coming on. You want to throw out the My Whiskey Den info again?
Sure. We are My Whiskey Den. You can find us on YouTube, Facebook. We're also on Instagram, though not quite as much. We do have some great shows coming up. Again, we focus mainly on American craft whiskey. But like you said, we've talked Irish, we'll talk Scotch, we'll talk a lot of different spirits. We get into brandy and rum and mezcal and other things as well. We've got a fantastic young distiller out of Kentucky coming on the show this Monday. We're on 8 o'clock Central, 9 o'clock Eastern Time, Monday nights on YouTube. We live stream. You can catch it on Facebook as well. But her name is Kelly Tennille. She's out of Hartfield. Is the name of the distillery, and they are the first distillery in Bourbon County, Kentucky in 100 years. And she's making some unique whiskeys that are absolutely fantastic. And she is an amazing person and extremely entertaining. So if you want to learn something, but also have a good laugh and be well entertained, I'd recommend tuning in for that.
I recommend your show regularly. I've been passing it on to the Irish American or American Irish Whiskey fan page for the last couple of weeks, because that's a group I'm part of, and I wanted to share your show with them. So hopefully people have caught on to that. We are at Whiskey Congress on Instagram and Twitter. And thank you for listening. Ben, thanks for coming on. We're done.